give up as soon as they saw the Amazons coming. Over the years, Atrera had grown rich and powerful and confident. She figured she could wipe out a drunken mob, no problem. Her fatal flaw? I'm thinking it was pride. She forgot what had happened to those village guys who tried to smack her down in the old days. Never underestimate your enemy. Dionysus was a god. It didn't matter how chummy Atrera was with Ares and Artemis. They couldn't help her against a fellow Olympian. The Amazons charged into battle and got thrashed. The Maenads tore them apart with their bare hands. Satyrs wailed on them with clubs and old wine bottles. Every time Dionysus snapped his fingers, another battalion of Amazons went insane, turned into wombats, or got choked to death in a thicket of grapevines. Atrera quickly realized she was outmatched. She pulled her forces just before they were all destroyed. Then the Amazons fled for their lives. Dionysus and his drunken army chased them halfway down the coast of Turkey. Finally, Atrera reached Ephesus and ran to the Temple of Artemis. She threw herself in front of the goddess's statue.
"Please, Lady Artemis," she begged, "save my people. Don't let them be destroyed because of my foolishness."
Artemis heard her and intervened. Or maybe Dionysus just got bored and decided to go kill somebody else. The wine god's army turned away and marched off to India, leaving Ephesus alone. The Amazons were saved. Eventually, they rebuilt their army and managed to get all the squished grapes out from between their toes. From then on, the Temple of Artemis got a reputation as a refuge for women. Any woman who reached the altar and begged for protection would be shielded by the power of Artemis. No one could harm her. The priestesses of the temple and the entire town of Ephesus would fight for her if necessary. After that, things settled down for Atrera. She retired to her capital at Sinope and ruled more or less in peace. She made alliances with her neighbors and brought safety and security to her people. The only thing she couldn't protect Amazons from? Other Amazons. Like what happened with her two wonderful, bloodthirsty daughters. As I said earlier, the great Ares-Atrera kickboxing marriage led to the birth of two daughters. Because of their parentage, they were both cute, sweet girls who liked glitter and ponies and frilly pink stuff. Yeah, not so much. Nobody knows exactly when Queen Atrera decided to retire, but after a while, all the battles and enslavements and wild dance parties got tiring. She handed control of the Amazons over to her elder daughter, Hippolyta. At first, Hippolyta did a good job. Her dad Ares was so pleased he gave her a magical suit of armor to wear for special events like bat mitzvahs and siege warfare. He also gave her a magical belt that made Hippolyta super strong. Unfortunately, Hippolyta had the bad luck of meeting a guy named Hercules. More on that in a bit. For now, let's just say there was a big fight and the Amazons suffered their worst defeat since the invasion of the Wine Dude. In the confusion of battle, Hippolyta was accidentally killed by her own sister, Penthesilea. The belt of the Amazons was lost, at least for a while. The Greeks got away. Penthesilea became the queen, and after mourning her sister's death, she rebuilt the Amazon army yet again. Even though it was an accident, Penthesilea never forgave herself for Hippolyta's death. She also never forgave the Greeks. Many years later, when the Trojan War broke out, she signed up to help Priam, the king of Troy, so she could crack Greek skulls and avenge her sister's death. That didn't work out so well. Penthesilea fought bravely and slaughtered a bunch of great warriors, but eventually she got killed by the most famous Greek fighter of all, Achilles. When Achilles retrieved her body from the battlefield, he washed her wounds so she could have a proper funeral. He took off her war helmet, saw how beautiful the Amazon queen was, and felt super depressed. It seemed like a waste that such a brave and extremely hot lady should die. Achilles waited for the next big truce, when Trojans and Greeks got together to exchange bodies for burial. Those meetings must have been fun. I'll trade you George here for Johnny and Billy Joe. Oh, wait, I think this leg belongs to Billy Joe. I'm not sure. Achilles presented the body of Penthesilea to the Trojans. He praised her bravery and beauty so much that one of his Greek comrades, a guy named Thersites, got annoyed. A bunch of Thersites' friends had been killed by Penthesilea. He turned to Achilles and said, "Dude, why are you praising her? She's an enemy and she's a woman. Are you in love with that dead girl?" He called her something worse than a girl. Achilles gently set Penthesilea down. He turned to his comrade and backhanded Thersites so hard all his teeth flew out like tiny white salmon leaping from a red stream. Thersites fell down dead. Achilles faced the Trojans. "Please bury Penthesilea with honor." The Trojans, not wishing to get killed by major dental trauma, did what he asked. I don't know if Atrera was still alive when her daughters died. For her sake, I kind of hope not. Even for a battle-hardened lady like Atrera, that would have been tough to deal with. Atrera and her daughters became legends, though, some of the greatest women warriors of all time. Maybe you're wondering why I included Atrera in this book, since it's about Greek heroes and technically she wasn't Greek. Maybe you're wondering whether she was really even a hero. I'll admit she had her flaws, the occasional murder, a massacre here and there. She also liked Ares, which is just gross. I have to get over my own prejudice, too. I had a run-in with Atrera once when she came back from the dead and tried to kill me. Long story, don't ask. But here's the thing. Women don't get a fair shake in the old stories. Even Atrera, the most famous, successful, and powerful woman of the ancient world, hardly gets a mention. I have to admire her guts. She went from being a downtrodden Bronze Age housewife to the queen of an empire. The Amazons became so famous, we named a river in Brazil after them, along with that modern company that has absolutely no connection to the ancient Amazon nation. Cough. To all the women she saved and trained for battle, Atrera was definitely a hero. She gave them hope. She gave them control over their own lives. Me? I would have gone a little easier on the whole beheading husbands thing, and I wouldn't have left baby boys in the wilderness to die, but she was a harsh lady living in harsh times. So, yeah, I think she belongs in a book of Greek heroes. If she gives you nightmares, the way she did those old Greek writers, well, just remember, the Amazons aren't around anymore. They faded out of history thousands of years ago. Wink, wink. There isn't much chance they'll come after you. Like a 20% chance at best. Maybe 30%. While we're talking about dead people I've encountered, I guess I'd better tackle another difficult subject. I gotta take a deep breath. This guy brings up some painful memories. Okay, I can do this. Let's talk about Daedalus, the greatest inventor of all time. Daedalus invents pretty much everything else. I have trouble writing about this guy. First off, my own experience with him doesn't jibe with the old stories. Of course, I wasn't there in ancient Greece. Some of the stuff I know personally comes from dreams, which aren't always reliable. I'll do my best to tell you what Daedalus was like back in the day, but if that seems to contradict what you've read in my adventures, that's because it does. Secondly, I have a hard time getting into this guy's head because, and I know this will come as a shock to you, I have never been a genius. Gasp! Percy, we thought you had an IQ of a billion! Yeah, sorry to burst your bubble. Understanding a super Einstein-type like Daedalus isn't easy for me. I have enough trouble comprehending my girlfriend, and she's no slouch in the brainiac department. Finally, well, Daedalus's life was just so weird. I guess that's no surprise. The dude was descended from a handkerchief. Maybe we should start with that. See, his great-grandfather, Erichthonius, was magically born from a rag Athena used to wipe Hephaestus's godly body fluid off her leg when Hephaestus tried to get too friendly. For more info, see The Olympians, Completely Disgusting Stories, or, you know, that Greek gods book I wrote. Since you can't have a better royal title than King Handkerchief, Erichthonius grew up to be the king of Athens. His offspring were demigod descendants of Athena and Hephaestus, the two most ingenious Olympians. Daedalus himself was never in line to be king, but he made his Olympian great-great-grandparents proud. He quickly got a reputation for being able to build or repair just about anything. Having trouble with your chariot suspension? Daedalus can fix that. Did your hard drive crash? Call 1-800-555-DAEDALUS. You want to build a mansion with a revolving roof deck, an infinity pool, and a state-of-the-art security system featuring boiling oil and mechanical crossbows? Piece of cake for the D-Man. Soon Daedalus was the most famous man in Athens. His repair shop had a 5-year waiting list for new clients. He designed and built all the best houses and temples and shopping centers. He sculpted statues so lifelike they would walk off their pedestals, blend in with the humans, and become productive members of society. Daedalus invented so many new technologies. Every fall, the media went crazy when he presented his latest version of the Daedalus Chisel TM, the Daedalus Wax Tablet TM, and of course, the Daedalus Spear TM with bronze tip technology, patent pending. The guy was a straight-up genius, but being a genius is hard work.
I'm simply too popular, Daedalus said to himself. I'm so busy fixing hard drives and inventing spectacular things, I don't have any me time. I should train an apprentice to do some of the grunt work for me.
It so happened that his sister had a son named Perdix. With a name like that, you know he must have gotten teased pretty bad on the playground. But this kid was smart. He had Athena's intelligence and Hephaestus's crafting skill. He was a real chip off the old hanky. Anyway, Daedalus hired his nephew. At first, Daedalus was delighted. Perdix could handle the most complicated repairs. He could look at a blueprint once and have it memorized. He even thought up some modifications for the Daedalus Spear TM 2.0, like the no-slip shaft and the customizable point that came in sharp, extra sharp, and super sharp. He was happy to give Daedalus the credit. Still, people started whispering, "That young kid, Perdix, he's almost as smart as his uncle." A few months later, Perdix invented a contraption called the pottery wheel. Instead of making your pots by hand, which took forever and made stupid lumpy pots, you could fashion clay on a whirling surface and make nice-looking bowls in just minutes. People started saying,
"That kid Perdix, he's even smarter than Daedalus."
Clients began asking for Perdix by name. They wanted him to design their mansion's infinity pool. They wanted him to retrieve the data from their crashed hard drives. Glory and fame started slipping away from Daedalus. One day, Daedalus was at the top of the Acropolis, the huge cliff-top fortress in the center of Athens, checking the site of a new temple he had designed, when Perdix ran up with a big leather pouch slung over his shoulder. "Uncle," Perdix grinned, "you have to see my new invention." Daedalus clenched his fists. At next week's press conference, he was set to announce the Daedalus Hammer, TM, and revolutionize the pounding of nails. He didn't need his upstart nephew stealing the spotlight with some annoyingly cool breakthrough.
"What is it now, Perdix?" he asked. "Please tell me this isn't more nonsense about bigger displays for my wax tablets."
"No, Uncle, look!"
From his leather pouch, Perdix pulled the jawbone of a small animal with a row of sharp teeth still intact.
"It's from a snake!"
Daedalus scowled.
"That isn't an invention."
"No, Uncle, I was playing around with it, running the teeth across a piece of wood, and I noticed they cut the surface. so I made this.
Perdix took out a wide metal blade fixed to a wooden handle. One side of the blade was serrated like a row of teeth.
I call it a saw.
Daedalus felt like he'd been smacked between the eyes with a Daedalus hammer, TM. He immediately realized the potential of Perdix's invention. Cutting boards with a saw instead of an axe would be easier, faster, and more accurate. It would change the lumber industry forever. And seriously, who hasn't dreamed of fame and riches in the lumber industry? If the saw ever became a thing, Perdix would become famous. Daedalus would be forgotten. Daedalus couldn't allow this young whippersnapper to eclipse his reputation.
Not bad.
Daedalus forced a smile.
We'll run some tests when we get back to the workshop. First, I want your opinion on this section of the cliff. I'm afraid it's not stable enough to support my new temple.
Sure, Uncle.
Perdix trotted over to the edge of the parapets.
Where?
About halfway down. Just lean over a bit and you'll see it. Here, let me hold your saw.
Okay.
Thanks.
Perdix leaned over.
I don't see.
Daedalus pushed the boy off the Acropolis. The exact details of how it happened, well, that depends on which story you believe. Some say Perdix didn't actually die. As the kid fell, Athena took pity on him and turned him into a partridge. That's why Perdix means partridge in ancient Greek. Definitely the goddess didn't appreciate Daedalus's murdering his nephew just because the boy had skills. Athena was all about cultivating new talent, and pushing smart kids off cliffs would lower the city's test score averages. From there on out, she made sure Daedalus's life was cursed. No more big press conferences, no more media frenzy. But if Athena did grant Perdix new life as a bird, how do you explain the big mess where the kid hit the bottom of Acropolis Hill? Daedalus saw it happen. He should have just walked away and feigned ignorance.
What? Perdix fell? You're kidding. That kid always was kind of clumsy.
Guilt got the better of him. He climbed down the cliff and wept over Perdix's body. He wrapped the remains in a tarp and dragged his poor nephew to the edge of town. He tried to dig a grave, but the ground was too rocky. I guess he hadn't invented the Daedalus shovel yet. A few locals spotted him. Before Daedalus could get away, a crowd gathered.
What are you burying?
Asked one guy. Daedalus was sweating like a marathon runner.
It's a snake.
The guy looked at the big wrapped-up lump. He nudged it with his foot and Perdix's right hand flopped out.
I'm pretty sure snakes don't have hands, the guy said.
Daedalus broke down in tears and confessed what he'd done. The crowd almost lynched him right then and there. You can't blame them for being angry. Half of them had appointments with Perdix to fix their chariots the next week. The crowd constrained themselves. They made a citizen's arrest and hauled Daedalus before the city judges. His trial was the lead story on the Athenian news network for weeks. His sister, Perdix's mom, argued for the death penalty. The thing was, Daedalus had done a lot of favors for wealthy citizens over the years. He'd built important buildings and patented many helpful inventions. The judges commuted his death sentence to permanent exile. Daedalus left Athens forever. Everyone figured he'd go off and die in a cave somewhere. But nope. For the murder he'd committed, Athena meant for Daedalus to live a long and tortured life. The inventor's punishment was just beginning. Daedalus moved to the island of Crete, which happened to be Athens' biggest rival at the time. King Minos of Crete had the most powerful navy in the Mediterranean. He was always harassing Athenian ships and disrupting their trade. You can imagine how the Athenians felt when they learned that their top inventor and hard drive repairman was now working for King Minos. It'd be kind of like if all of America's best products were suddenly made in China. Oh, wait. Anyway, Daedalus arrived at Minos's palace for his job interview, and Minos was like, "Why did you leave your previous position?"
"I was convicted of murder,"
Daedalus said.
"I pushed my nephew off the Acropolis."
Minos stroked his beard.
"So it wasn't about the quality of your work?" "No, I am as clever and skillful as ever. I just murdered someone."
"Well, then I see no problem," Minos said.
"You're hired."
Minos gave him tons of money. He set Daedalus up in a cutting-edge workshop in the capital city of Knossos. Soon Daedalus's reputation was back, bigger and better than ever. He cranked out dozens of new inventions and built all the best temples and mansions in the kingdom. He lived happily ever after for about 6 minutes. The problem was, King Minos had daddy issues. He was the son of Zeus, which sounds like a good thing, but it didn't help him much as the king of Crete. Long story short, the relationship between Zeus and Minos's mom, Europa, had started in a weird way. Zeus turned into a bull, coaxed Europa onto his back, and swam away with her, carrying her across the sea to Crete. Zeus and Europa spent enough time together to have 3 kids. Minos was the oldest, but eventually, Zeus got tired of his mortal girlfriend, the way gods always do, and he went back to Mount Olympus. Europa married the king of Crete, a dude named Asterion. That worked out okay for a while. Asterion really loved Europa. They never had any kids of their own, so the king adopted the 3 little Zeus juniors. When Asterion died, Minos became the king. A lot of the locals grumbled about that. Minos was adopted. His real dad was supposedly Zeus, but they'd heard the same claim from plenty of others before. Every time some unwed girl in the city got pregnant, she was like, "Oh, yeah, it was totally Zeus." Minos's mom wasn't even from Crete. She'd illegally immigrated on a bull. Why should Minos be king? Minos took this personally. He released his birth certificate showing he'd been born on Crete and everything, but the people didn't care. He married a local princess, Pasiphae, who was the daughter of the sun god Helios. Together, they had a whole mess of kids, including a smart, beautiful daughter named Ariadne. You would figure that having a son of Zeus for your king and a daughter of Helios for your queen would be good enough, but no, not for the Cretans. They were still like, "Minos is a foreigner. His dad was a bull. I think Minos is secretly working for the cattle." Minos decided he needed to do a better job of marketing his brand. People wanted to talk about his parentage. Okay, he was the son of Zeus and proud of it. Minos adopted the bull as his royal symbol. He had bulls painted on his banners. He had Daedalus design a giant mosaic bull for the throne room floor and engrave golden bull heads on his throne's armrests. He got bull-patterned silverware, bull topiaries for the garden, even bull-patterned boxer shorts and fuzzy slippers shaped like cute little bull faces. Everybody who came to the palace on Wednesdays got a free bull bobblehead as a door prize. Somehow the slippers and bobbleheads didn't convince his subjects of Minos's divine right to be king. They kept grumbling and not paying their taxes and whatnot. Finally, Minos decided he needed a big demonstration of his royal cred, something that would wow the Cretans and settle the matter once and for all. He called in Daedalus, since the inventor was the smartest guy in the kingdom.
"I recommend special effects," Daedalus said. "Flash powder, smoke bombs. I could build a huge talking robot to carry you around town and announce to everyone how awesome you are."
Minos frowned.
"No, I need a sign from the gods." "I can fake that," Daedalus said. "We'll use mirrors, maybe some guys flying around on invisible wires."
"No," Minos snapped. "It must not be faked. It must be real."
Daedalus scratched his head.
"You mean like actually praying to the gods in public and hoping they send you a sign? I don't know, boss. Sounds risky."
The king was adamant. He had a big platform constructed down by the docks. He called together the entire city population, then raised his arms to the crowd and shouted,
"Some of you doubt that I am your rightful king. I will prove that the gods support me. I will ask them to give me a sign."
In the audience, somebody made a raspberry sound.
"That's no proof. You'll just ask your daddy for a favor."
Minos blushed.
"No."
Actually, he had been planning to ask Zeus for a bolt of lightning, but now that plan was ruined.
"I will, pray to a totally different god."
He gazed out at the harbor and got an idea.
"Crete has the world's greatest navy, right? I will ask Poseidon, Lord of the Seas, to grant me his blessing."
"Please, Poseidon," Minos prayed silently. "I know we haven't talked much, but help me out here. I'll pay you back. Maybe you could make an animal miraculously pop out of the sea. I promise, as soon as the show is over, whatever animal you send, I will sacrifice it to you."
Down at the bottom of the sea, Poseidon heard his prayer. He didn't really care about Minos one way or the other, but he liked sacrifices. He also liked people praying to him, and he never passed up an opportunity to look awesome in front of a major naval power. Poseidon said to himself. "Minos wants an animal. He likes bulls. I like bulls being sacrificed to me. Hey, I know. I'll send him a bull." The harbor churned with froth. Boats pitched at their moorings. A 40-foot wave rose up from nowhere, and riding the crest was a massive white bull. He landed on the docks, all cool and regal-looking, his head held high, his white horns gleaming.
"Ooh, ah," said the crowd,
because it wasn't every day a bull surfed a gnarly peak into the harbor. The Cretans turned to Minos and started cheering. The king bowed and thanked them and sent everybody home with commemorative bull-shaped coffee mugs. The king's men put a rope around the bull's neck and led him to the royal bullpen. Later that evening, Minos and Daedalus went to inspect the animal, which was even more magnificent up close, at least twice as big and strong as any other bull in the royal herd.
"Wow," Minos said, "that's some bull. I think I'll keep him for breeding."
Daedalus chewed his thumbnail.
Are you sure, Your Majesty? If you promise to sacrifice the bull to Poseidon, well, keeping him wouldn't be the right thing to do, would it?"
The king snorted. "You pushed your own nephew off the Acropolis. What do you know about right and wrong?" Daedalus got a really bad feeling in his gut. Special effects he could control. The Olympian gods? Well, even he hadn't invented a good machine for predicting how they would react. He tried to convince the king to sacrifice the white bull, but Minos wouldn't listen.
"You worry too much," the king told him. "I'll sacrifice one of my other bulls to Poseidon. He won't care. He probably won't even notice the difference."
Poseidon cared. He noticed the difference. When he realized Minos was keeping the beautiful white bull instead of sacrificing it like he promised, Poseidon blew up like a pufferfish.
"Dude, making that bull took me like 5 seconds of hard work. Okay, Minos, you think you're so great? You love bulls so much? You'll regret it. I'll make sure you never want to see another bull in your entire life."
Poseidon could have punished Crete directly. He could have destroyed Knossos with an earthquake or wiped out the entire Cretan fleet with a tidal wave, but that would have only made the people of the island mad at him. Poseidon wanted to humiliate the royal family and make everyone disgusted with Minos and Pasiphae, but he didn't want any blowback. He wanted the people of Crete to keep praying and sacrificing at his temple.
"I need a sneaky way to get revenge," Poseidon decided. "Let's see. Who specializes in sneaky and embarrassing?"
Poseidon went to see the love goddess Aphrodite, who was hanging out in her day spa on Mount Olympus.
"You won't believe this," Poseidon told her. "You know King Minos of Crete?"
"Hmm?"
Aphrodite kept reading her fashion magazine.
"I suppose."
He dissed me. He promised to sacrifice a bull, and he didn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
Aphrodite scanned the ads for Givenchy bags.
Also, Poseidon said, that queen of his, Pasiphae, you should have heard what she said about you.
Aphrodite glanced up. Excuse me?
I mean, sure, Pasiphae is beautiful, Poseidon said, but people are always talking about how lovely she is compared to you. And the queen never discourages them. Can you believe that?
Aphrodite closed her magazine. Her eyes glowed a dangerous shade of pink. People are comparing this mortal queen to me? She allows it?
Yeah. And when was the last time Pasiphae made a sacrifice at your temple or called you the best goddess?
Aphrodite ran through her mental list of sacrifices and prayers. She kept close track of which mortals paid her the proper respects. Pasiphae's name wasn't anywhere in the top 20. That ungrateful witch, Aphrodite said. To be fair, Pasiphae really was a witch. She loved sorcery and potions. She was even more grasping and arrogant than her husband, basically not a nice person at all. But to blame her for not being an Aphrodite fangirl, well, that's like blaming me for not being a frequent flyer. Zeus and me, we try to stay out of each other's territory. Anyway, Poseidon saw an opportunity for revenge, and he took it. I can't defend my dad's choice. Even the best gods can be vicious if you get on their bad side.
You should totally punish her, Poseidon suggested. Make the queen and king a laughingstock for failing to honor me. I mean, failing to honor you.
What did you have in mind? Aphrodite asked. Poseidon's eyes gleamed brighter than his Hawaiian shirt.
Perhaps the queen should fall in love. She should have the most disgusting, embarrassing love affair of all time.
With David Hasselhoff?
Worse.
Charlie Sheen?
Worse. Minos's royal symbol is a bull, right? In his pens, he keeps a pure white bull that he loves more than anything in the world. What if the queen fell in love with that bull, too?
Even for Aphrodite, the idea took a moment to sink in. Oh, gods. Oh, you don't mean... Oh, that's sick.
Poseidon grinned. Isn't it?
Aphrodite took some convincing. She went to the little goddess's room, threw up, fixed her face, and came back out. Very well, she decided. This is an appropriate punishment for a queen who has never honored me.
Or me, said Poseidon.
Whatever, said Aphrodite. The goddess went to work with her voodoo love magic. The next day, down on Crete, Pasiphae was walking past the royal bullpens as quickly as possible to avoid the smell when she happened to glance at the king's prize white bull. She stopped in her tracks. It was true love. Okay, folks. At this point, feel free to put down the book and run around in circles screaming, "Ew!" That's pretty much what I did the first time I heard this story. Greek myths have a lot of gross stuff in them, but this, right here, is a major league wretch fest. The thing is, Pasiphae had done nothing to deserve it. Sure, she was an awful person who dabbled in dark sorcery, but we all have our faults. She wasn't the one who had failed to sacrifice the bull. She hadn't insulted Aphrodite. It's kind of like the fates were saying, "Okay, Minos, you did something bad. Well, see how you like it when we punish this random person over here." Pasiphae tried to shake her feelings. She knew they were wrong and disgusting, but she couldn't. She went back to her room and sat on her bed all day, reading books about bulls, drawing pictures of the bull, until she ran out of white crayons, writing the bull's name on all her notebooks. Bull. She struggled for weeks, trying to convince herself that she wasn't really in love with a fine specimen of livestock. But still, she walked around in a daze, humming "Hooked on a Feeling" and "Milk Cow Blues." She tried to cure herself with spells and potions. Nothing worked. Then, in desperation, she tried sorcery to make the bull like her too. She found excuses to walk past the bullpen in her best dress with her hair done up nice. She muttered incantations. She poured love potions into the bull's trough. Nada. The bull had absolutely no interest. To him, Pasiphae was just another stupid human who wasn't bringing him fresh hay or waving a red flag in his face or doing anything interesting. Finally, Pasiphae sought out the help of the only person she considered even smarter than herself, Daedalus. The inventor was in his workshop, looking over architectural drawings for the Knossos Football Stadium and Convention Center, when the queen came in. She explained her problem and what she wanted him to do about it. Daedalus glanced around, wondering if he was being secretly filmed for a reality show.
So, wait. You want me to do what now?
Pasiphae winced. Explaining it once had been embarrassing enough.
I need to make the bull notice me. I know he'll love me back if I can just convince him...
He's a bull.
Yes, the queen snapped. So I need him to think I'm a cow.
Daedalus tried to keep his expression neutral.
I'm serious. Use your mechanical super-duper know-how to make me a fake cow suit. I'll slip inside, introduce myself to the bull, flirt a little, ask him where he's from, that sort of thing. I'm sure he'll fall in love with me. It has to be an attractive fake cow suit.
Your Majesty, I don't think I can...
Of course you can. You're a genius. What are we paying you for?
I'm pretty sure your husband isn't paying me for this.
Pasiphae sighed. Let me break it down for you. If you breathe a word of this to Minos, I will deny it. You will be executed for spreading lies about the queen. If you refuse to help me, I'll tell Minos you made a pass at me. You'll be executed for that. The only way to avoid being executed is to help me.
A line of sweat trickled down Daedalus's neck.
I'm just saying, it isn't right.
You pushed your nephew off the Acropolis. What do you know about right and wrong?
Daedalus really wished people would stop bringing that up. One little murder, and they never let you forget it. He didn't want to help the queen. A mechanical cow suit so she could chat up a bull? Even Daedalus had limits, but he also had his career and his family to think about. Since arriving on Crete, he'd gotten married. He now had a little boy named Icarus. Getting executed would make it difficult for Daedalus to attend his son's kindergarten back-to-school night. The inventor decided he had no choice. He began working on the most attractive fake cow costume ever built by man. As soon as the mechanical disguise was done, the queen slipped inside. Daedalus bribed the guards so they wouldn't notice anything strange about the inventor wheeling a fake cow from his workshop to the royal bullpen. That night, the bull finally noticed Pasiphae.
This is a good time for all of us to put down the book again, run around in circles screaming, "Ew!" and wash our eyes out with Visine.
How did Aphrodite and Poseidon feel when their plan worked? I hope they weren't sitting around Mount Olympus high-fiving each other and saying, "We did it!" I prefer to think they were staring in horror at the scene down in Crete and saying, "Oh, gods! What have we done?" 9 months later, a very pregnant Queen Pasiphae was about to give birth. King Minos couldn't wait. He was hoping for a son. He'd even picked out a name, Asterion, in honor of his stepfather, the former king. The people of Crete would love that. Minor hitch in the plan. The boy was born a monster. From the shoulders down, he was human. From the shoulders up, he had coarse fur, neck tendons like steel cables, and the head of a bull. His horns started growing right away, which made it impossible to carry him around in a baby sling without getting gored. The king wasn't as bright as Daedalus, but he figured out pretty quickly that the kid couldn't be his. The royal couple argued. They threw things. They screamed and yelled and chased off the servants, all of which must have been pretty upsetting for the poor baby. No one was more horrified than Pasiphae. Aphrodite's love curse had broken as soon as the baby was born. The queen was disgusted with herself, the gods, and especially the baby. She confessed what had happened, but she couldn't explain her actions. How could she? Anyway, the damage was done. This wasn't something the royal couple could work through in marriage counseling. Pasiphae moved to a separate apartment in the palace. She lived under house arrest for the rest of her life. Minos was tempted to toss the monster baby into the sea, but something held him back. Maybe the old taboo against killing your family, or maybe he had an inkling that the child was a punishment for him, a sick, twisted message from Poseidon. If so, killing the kid would only make the gods angrier. Minos tried to hush up the details of the birth, but it was too late. Nursemaids, midwives, and servants had all seen the baby. Nothing travels faster than bad news, especially when it happens to someone nobody likes. The people of Crete were now sure that their king wasn't fit to rule. The mutant child was clearly a curse from the gods. The kid's name, Asterion, was an insult to the old king's memory, so the people didn't call him that. Everybody called the boy the Minotaur, the bull of Minos. Minos turned bitter. He blamed everyone else. The gods, his wife, the bull, the ungrateful people of Crete. He couldn't punish them all. His popularity ratings were low enough as it was. But there was one person he could punish, someone who'd been involved in the plot and who made a perfect punching bag. He had Daedalus dragged before him in chains. "You," snarled the king. "I gave you a second chance. I gave you a job, a workshop, R&D funding, and this is how you repay me? You have destroyed my reputation, inventor. Unless you can invent something that will make this right, I'll kill you slowly and painfully. Then I'll find a way to resurrect you and I'll kill you again." Daedalus was used to coming up with brilliant ideas. Normally, he didn't have to do so while he was chained up and surrounded by guards with pointy swords, but he was highly motivated to think fast.
"We'll turn it into a positive," he yelped.
Minos's stare was as cold as dry ice.
"My wife fell in love with a bull. She gave birth to a monster. You want to turn that into a positive?"
"Yes," Daedalus said. "We'll use that. Look, your people will never love you. That's obvious."
"You're not making this better."
"But we can make them fear you. Your enemies will tremble when they hear your name. Your own subjects will never dare cross you."
The king's eyes narrowed.
"Go on." "Rumors about the Minotaur have already started to spread. His name is Asterion."
"No, sire, we embrace his monstrousness. We call him the Minotaur. We never show him to anyone. We let imaginations run wild. As bad as he is, we encourage people to think he's even worse. As he grows, we'll keep him locked away in the dungeons and feed him. I don't know, spoiled meat and Tabasco sauce. Something to make him really angry. We'll throw prisoners in his cell from time to time and let the Minotaur practice killing them."
"Wow," said Minos, "and I thought I was cruel. Keep talking."
"Every time the Minotaur kills a prisoner, we'll give him a piece of candy. He'll learn to be a vicious, murderous beast. Once he's fully grown..."
Daedalus got a light in his eyes that made even the king nervous.
"What?" Minos asked. "What happens when he's grown?"
"By then, I'll be done building the Minotaur's new home. It'll be a prison like no other, a huge maze right behind the palace. The top will be open to the sky, but the walls will be tall and impossible to climb. The corridors will shift and turn. The whole place will be full of traps. And at the center, that's where the Minotaur will live.
Minos got a chill just imagining it.
So, how would we feed him?
Daedalus smiled. He was really getting into the whole evil genius thing now.
Whenever you have someone you want to punish, you push them into the maze. You promise that if they can find their way out, you'll let them live. But I'll make sure no one can ever locate an exit. Eventually, they'll get lost. They'll die of thirst or hunger, or the Minotaur will find them and eat them. Their screams will echo from the maze across the entire city. The Minotaur will become everyone's worst nightmare. No one will ever make fun of you again.
Minos tapped his chin. I like your plan. Build this maze. We will call it the Fun House.
I was thinking something more mysterious and terrifying, Daedalus said. Perhaps the Labyrinth?
Fine. Whatever. Now get to work before I change my mind and kill you. Daedalus put in more hours on the Labyrinth than he had on any other invention. More than the Daedalus Chisel TM, the Daedalus Wax Tablet TM, or even the Daedalus Food Processor TM that made mounds and mounds of julienne fries. He worked so hard that he neglected his family. His wife left him. His son Icarus grew up barely knowing his father. For 15 years, Daedalus labored, creating what looked like a trench warfare playground in the backyard of the palace. Fortunately, it was a really big backyard. If you put the Mall of America, Walt Disney World, and 20 football stadiums together, they would all fit inside the labyrinth with room to spare. 30-foot-tall brick walls zigzagged across the landscape. Corridors narrowed and widened, looping in curlicues, crossing and splitting. Some submerged underground and became tunnels. Others dead-ended or opened into gardens where every plant was poisonous. The walls shifted. Trapdoors and pits riddled the floors. If you were sentenced to the labyrinth, the guards would shove you inside. The entrance would vanish like it had never been there. The maze was so disorienting, as soon as you took 3 steps, you'd be lost. The fact that you could see the sky just made it feel more claustrophobic. It was almost like the labyrinth was alive, growing and changing and trying to kill you. Believe me on this. I've been inside. It's not one of those places where you think, when I grow up, I'm totally taking my kids here every summer. Daedalus completed his work just in time. The Minotaur was getting so strong that no cell in the dungeon could hold him. He had entered his teen years, and like a lot of us teens, myself excluded, of course, he could be sulky and angry and destructive. Unlike most teens, the Minotaur had sharp horns, blood-red eyes, and fists the size of battering rams. Since he was a little kid, he'd been whipped, beaten, and trained to kill. For a piece of candy, he would gladly tear a human apart with his bare hands. Somehow, Minos managed to coax the Minotaur into his new home at the center of the labyrinth, maybe by leaving a trail of Skittles. Once there, the Minotaur was ready to play his part as the most fearsome monster ever. At night, he bellowed at the moon, and the sound echoed through the streets of Knossos. Minos began throwing prisoners into the maze. Sure enough, they never came back. Either they got lost and died of thirst, if they were lucky, or they met the Minotaur, in which case their dying screams provided a lovely soundtrack for life in the big city. The crime rate in Knossos went down 97%. So did King Minos's popularity. But everyone was too scared of him and his monstrous son to say anything. Daedalus's plan had worked. He designed the most complicated, dangerous maze in human history. He'd turned Minos's disgrace into a source of power and fear. For his reward, he was granted life in prison
Yippee!
Minos locked Daedalus in his own labyrinth, in a lovely suite of cells with a fully stocked workshop so he could keep making brilliant things for the king. The guards checked on him daily, using magical thread to find their way in and out of the maze, and made sure Daedalus wasn't up to anything funny. To encourage the old man's cooperation, Minos kept Icarus a captive in the palace. Icarus was only allowed to visit his father every other Tuesday, but those visits were the highlight of Daedalus's new, miserable life. He wished he'd never heard of Crete or Minos or Pasiphae. He never wanted to see another bull as long as he lived. Every night he had to listen to the minotaur mooing and banging around next door. The labyrinth walls rumbled and groaned as they shifted, making it impossible for the old man to sleep. Being a genius inventor and all, Daedalus spent most of his time devising escape plans. Getting through the maze itself was no problem. Daedalus could navigate it easily, but the exit was locked and heavily guarded. Minos' army patrolled the perimeter 24/7. Even if Daedalus somehow could manage to slip out unnoticed, Minos controlled all the ships in the harbor. Daedalus would be arrested before he could ever board one. To make matters worse, his son was the king's prisoner. If Daedalus fled, Icarus would be executed. Daedalus needed a way to get off the island with his son, a way that didn't involve land or sea. The inventor began working on his greatest bad idea ever. Daedalus's timeline got pushed up when the labyrinth suffered its first jailbreak. A guy named Theseus pulled it off with a little inside help, but we'll get to that in a bit. For now, let's just say it put Minos in a seriously bad mood. And when Minos got in a bad mood, he tended to take it out on his favorite punching bag, Daedalus. The inventor figured he'd outlived his usefulness. His days were numbered. He sped up work on his amazing, terrible idea. He told no one about his plans except his son. Icarus had grown into a sweet, handsome young man, but he was no inventor. He was no Perdix. Daedalus liked it that way. Icarus worshipped his dad and trusted him completely. So when Daedalus told him they were breaking out of the labyrinth together, Icarus did a happy dance.
"Awesome," Icarus said. "Are you building a bulldozer?"
"What?"
Daedalus asked.
"No, that wouldn't work."
"But you said break out."
"It's a figure of speech. There's no way to escape by land or sea. Minos has those routes covered. But there's one way he can't guard."
Daedalus pointed at the sky. Icarus nodded.
"Springs on our shoes. We will jump to freedom."
"No."
"Train pigeons. We'll tie dozens of them to large lawn chairs and..."
"No, although you're getting warmer. We'll fly out of here under our own power."
Daedalus told him the plan. He warned Icarus not to talk about it and to be ready to leave when he visited the labyrinth again in 2 weeks. After Icarus left, Daedalus went to work. His forge glowed day and night as he smelted bronze and hammered out pieces of his new contraption. By this point, he was getting old. His eyesight wasn't as good as it used to be. His hands shook. His project required intricate sculpting and painstaking precision. After a few days, he was wishing he'd gone with the pigeon-powered launcher idea. 2 weeks flew by. When Icarus came back to visit, the boy was alarmed at how much frailer his father looked.
"Dad, the guards were acting funny," Icarus warned. "They said something about telling you goodbye and this being our last visit."
"I knew it," Daedalus muttered. "The king is planning to execute me. We have to hurry."
Daedalus opened his supply cabinet and pulled out his new invention, 2 sets of human-sized bronze wings, each feather perfectly crafted, all the joints fully articulated.
"Whoa," said Icarus, "shiny."
"Do you remember our plan?"
Daedalus asked.
"Yeah. Here, Dad, I'll attach your wings."
The old man wanted to argue. He would have preferred that his son be ready to go first, but he was exhausted. He let Icarus fasten the straps on his leather harness, then use hot wax to fuse the wings into place on his back and arms. It wasn't a perfect design, but it was the best Daedalus could do on short notice with the supplies he had. The guards weren't about to let him have any good adhesive. With super glue or duct tape, Daedalus could have conquered the world.
"Hurry, son," Daedalus urged. "The guards will be bringing lunch soon."
Or, if Minos really had decided to kill him, they might bring a guillotine instead of the usual cheese sandwich. Icarus attached the last pinion to his father's wrist. "There! You're ready to fly! Now do mine!" The old man's hand shook. Several times, he spilled hot wax on his son's shoulders, but Icarus didn't complain. Daedalus was about to do a final safety check when the workshop door burst open. King Minos himself stormed inside, flanked by guards. The king looked at Daedalus and Icarus in their new bronze wings.
"What have we here?" Minos said. "Giant bronze chickens? Perhaps I should pluck you and make soup."
One of the guards laughed.
"Soup! Icarus, go!"
Daedalus kicked open the forge's floor vent. A blast of hot air from below lifted Icarus into the sky.
"Stop them!" Minos yelled.
Daedalus spread his wings. The hot wind carried him aloft. The guards hadn't brought bows, so all they could do was throw their swords and helmets while King Minos yelled and shook his fists. The inventor and his son soared away. At first, the trip was awesome. Kind of like the beginning of Phaethon's Sun Chariot ride, except without the sun-related tunes or the built-in Bluetooth. Icarus whooped with delight as they glided away from Crete.
"We did it! Dad, we did it!"
"Son, be careful,"
Daedalus cried, struggling to keep up.
"Remember what I told you."
"I know."
Icarus swooped down next to him. "Not too low, or the seawater will corrode the wings. Not too high, or the sun will melt the wax."
"Right," Daedalus said. "Stick to the middle of the sky."
Again, that might sound familiar from Phaethon's driver's education class. The Greeks were all about staying in the middle, avoiding extremes. They were the original nation of Goldilockses. Not too hot, not too cold, just right. Of course, that doesn't mean they were any good at following the rule.
"I'll be careful, Dad," Icarus promised. "But first, watch this! Woohoo!"
He did loops and twirls. He dive-bombed the waves, then soared up and tried to touch the clouds. Daedalus yelled at him to stop, but you know us crazy kids. Give us wings, and all we want to do is fly. Icarus kept saying,
"Just one more time! These wings are great, Dad!"
Daedalus couldn't do much to stop him. The old guy was having enough trouble just staying aloft. Now that they were over the middle of the sea, he couldn't exactly stop to rest. Icarus thought, "I wonder how high I can go. Dad's wings will hold up. Dad is awesome. He's super smart." Icarus shot into the clouds. Somewhere below, he heard his dad yelling, but Icarus was too busy enjoying the adrenaline rush.
"I can touch the sun," he told himself. "I can totally touch the sun."
He totally couldn't touch the sun. The wax points melted. The bronze feathers began to molt. With a loud metallic rip, like a bag of cans in a trash compactor, the wings peeled away. Icarus fell. Daedalus screamed until his throat was sore, but there was nothing he could do. His son plummeted 300 feet and hit the water, which from that height might as well have been pavement. Icarus sank beneath the waves. In his honor, that stretch of water is still called the Icarian Sea. Though why you'd want to be memorialized by the thing that killed you, I'm not sure. If I ever bite it, please don't let them dedicate the Percy Jackson Memorial Brick Wall, the Percy Jackson Very Sharp Spear, or the Percy Jackson Memorial 16-wheeler going 100 miles an hour. I would not feel honored. Heartbroken, Daedalus was tempted to give up. He could simply fall into the sea and die, joining his son in the underworld, but his survival instinct was pretty strong. So was his instinct for revenge. Minos had driven them to this escape plan. Minos was responsible for his son's death. The king needed to pay. The inventor flew on into the night. He had more things to invent, more trouble to cause, and at least one really satisfying death to arrange. Daedalus made it all the way to the island of Sicily, off the southwest tip of Italy. That's like 500 miles from Crete, which is a long way for an old dude flapping metal wings. When he landed, he was the first person ever to use that lame gag.
"I just flew in from Crete, and boy, are my arms tired."
Fortunately, the Sicilians didn't apply the death penalty for corny jokes. They took Daedalus to meet the local king, a guy named Caucalus, and the king couldn't believe his luck. Nobody famous ever came to Sicily.
"Oh my gods!" The king leaped out of his throne. "Daedalus? The Daedalus?"
King Caucalus started fangirling all around the throne room.
"Can I get a photo with you? Will you sign my crown? I can't believe it. The Daedalus, in my kingdom. I have to tell all the neighboring kings. They'll be so jealous."
Yeah, about that.
Daedalus explained that he'd just escaped from King Minos, who had the most powerful navy in the Mediterranean and would no doubt be looking for him.
"Maybe it's best if we keep my presence here on the down low."
Caucalus's eyes widened.
"Right, the down low, got it. If you work for me, you can have whatever you want. We'll keep your identity a secret. We'll give you a code name like, not Daedalus. No one will suspect a thing." Or how about Metalus or Jimmy?
Daedalus realized he had some work ahead of him. He'd have to make sure the royal brain didn't get pulled over for going under the speed limit. Still, it beat sitting in the labyrinth. Soon, Daedalus was the king's most trusted advisor. He could read entire sentences, spell words, even do math. Truly, he was a wizard. King Caucalus was as good as his word, as long as you didn't ask him to spell his word. He kept Daedalus a secret. He gave the old inventor a suite of rooms in the palace, a new workshop, even a good tool set from Ace Hardware in Athens, which was not easy to import. Of course, Sicily wasn't Crete. Caucalus didn't have nearly as much power or wealth as Minos, so Daedalus didn't have as many resources to work with, but he was definitely appreciated. He was the biggest thing that had ever happened in that part of the world. He sort of liked the attention. Caucalus might have been a doofus, but the king's three daughters were all smart with a ruthless streak. Daedalus thought they might make fine rulers someday. He began tutoring them on the basics of being a monarch: math, reading, writing, warfare, basic torture, tax collection, advanced torture, and tax collection with advanced torture. The princesses were quick learners. Daedalus also did a ton of stuff for the locals. He introduced indoor plumbing. He built nice buildings. He taught the people how to tell if their clothes were on inside out. It was quite a renaissance down there in Caucalus's kingdom. If you go to Sicily today, you can still see some of the stuff Daedalus built. The thermal baths in Salinas, a water reservoir in Hybla, an aqueduct and some fortifications in Kamikos, the temple of Apollo in Cumae, and don't miss the giant dancing bronze sloth in Palermo. Okay, that last one isn't there anymore, which is a bummer. It must have been awesome. Daedalus became so popular that he started piling up gifts from the grateful people. Many Sicilians named their kids Jimmy, or not Daedalus, in his honor. Daedalus figured that sooner or later the Cretan navy would come calling, so he built King Caucalus a new castle high on a cliff.
Its one entry gate was at the top of a steep path, and four men could easily defend it against an entire army. On the downside, that made for a real bottleneck situation during rush hour. For a while, life was good. Some nights, Daedalus could even sleep without having nightmares about Queen Pasiphae in her fake bull costume, or Icarus falling into the sea, or his nephew Perdix tumbling off the Acropolis. But King Minos hadn't forgotten about the inventor. He gathered his fleet and slowly made his way around the Mediterranean, searching for Daedalus in every city. Minos was clever about it. Instead of banging on doors and threatening people, he set out bait that he figured Daedalus couldn't resist. Minos said he was holding a contest to find the most ingenious person in the world. Whoever could thread a cord through a conch shell without breaking the shell would win eternal fame and an assload of gold. By which I mean as much gold as could be carried by a strong donkey. Jeez, you people, what did you think I meant? Why did Minos pick the conch shell challenge? Maybe he wanted to start a new fashion trend with extremely large seashell necklaces. If you've ever seen a conch shell, you know they're really curly on the inside. You can get your hand in partially, but it's impossible to coax a thread all the way through the spiral and out of the top, especially not with the technology they had back then. Word of the contest spread. A lot of people wanted eternal fame. An assload of gold didn't sound too bad either. When Daedalus heard about the challenge, he just smiled. He had predicted that Minos would try something like this sooner or later. He went to see King Caucalus.
Your Majesty, about this conch shell contest, I intend to enter it and win.
The king frowned.
But if you send in the winning entry, even if you do so under a fake name, won't Minos suspect it's you?
Yes.
But then he'll come here. He'll demand to see the winner and...
Right.
Wait, you want him to come here?
Daedalus realized he still had some work to do on the king's brain speed capacity.
Yes, my friend. Don't worry. I have a plan.